from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll chat with author Van Kirby about his memoir of being a gay dad in Indiana.
I'll find out about a new collaboration that brings lots of great things out of various organizations' archives.
And I'll talk with the stars, Michael Anthony Adams, who's trying to get everyone to read 26 books this year. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What Do We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. In the 1970s, Van Kirby, a successful Indianapolis business owner who's also gay, fought for and won the right to raise his four children. He tells his unlikely story in a new book titled On the Table by the Window, The Journey of a Gay Dad in Indiana, that he co-wrote with David Hoppe of Nuvo. Travis DiNicola spoke with Van about the book.
It's the holidays again, another Christmas. It's a little different. I'm relaxed, for one thing. And I'm about to be a great grandpa. I have three daughters, Debbie, Laura, and Michelle. We'll be together in the next few days, assembling gifts and taking to homeless shelters. My son, Scott, who lives on the East Coast, would be here helping us too if he, of course, lived, you know, in town. As for my grandkids, well, they're all into the trips of their own at this point. That's fine with me. Didn't I say I was relaxed? The holidays, of course, are the time when families get together. Our family is no different. That, I suppose, is the point of this book. For the past 40 years, Daniel Dietrich and I have lived together. Dan is my lover, best friend, and in every way, I can imagine, partner. We're not married. It's illegal where we live in Indiana. But we've made this life for ourselves here anyway. How we got to this point, including winning custody of my kids, and how we managed to bring them up is a large part of what this book is about.
Very good. Yes, it is. It's an incredible story and an inspiring story. You've been fortunate to be able to work with David Hoppe, who many of us know from Nuvo, and I know that he worked on this book with you. And congratulations on your book, by the way. Let's just start with that.
Thank you very much. And as far as David Hoppe goes, of course, people say, oh, Van, you wrote a book. And I say, yes, I did. And I very seldom ever mention his name, but... The fact is that, that's what I told him. I said, the fact is that David just was incredible and is incredible. He's an incredible guy. Put it together, and the best compliment that I've gotten with people who know me, who read the book, says that they just are blown away with how much this sounds like me.
Yeah.
You know, so I guess that's credit to David because he sorted through a lot of stuff to get there, so...
Well, let's roll back to, I'm guessing, sort of late 60s, early 70s.
I was married in 1963.
Okay.
And I was 19.
Mm-hmm.
And was married because I thought that's what we were supposed to do, being Catholic
sure.
kids, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And as it says in the book, you know, my dad said, find you a good woman and she'll fix you, you know? I was thinking of a fix different than he was, I think, because I think he was thinking about fixing dinner or whatever. But
yeah.
Anyway, I found a woman, and we were married. But
you had a pretty good idea you were gay at that point.
Yes, yes. I knew I was. But you know, then in 19...
Defining it as gay, that was a very different thing in the 60s.
Well, you know, I don't think I really knew I was gay because there was just no definition, as you said.
Yeah.
But... You know, it was listed as a, you know, Webster's listed it as a mental illness. You know, I think until 1961 they took that out. So it was very, very new. And, you know, for a while I thought I was mentally ill. And it was one of those things that people thought they could catch. You know, homosexuality was something that you could catch. So if it was a mental illness, then you could be fixed. You could be, you know, cured from it, was the premise. I think nowadays people still think that, you know, that,
some do.
Oh, if you just, you know, do this and this, you'll be cured. So.
So you got married and you, four kids, correct?
Right. I have a son and three daughters.
At what point did you decide this? And that's such a hard decision. I can't even imagine by being married with four children to say, I can't do this anymore. I can't live the life that I've been living this way.
Well, that was progressive because, you know, I've always said that I really love my children's mother. Mm-hmm. I think to say that you fall out of love is, I don't fall in and out of love. I think love lasts forever. You fall in and out of like. So I think to say you don't love the parents of your children, your ex or whatever, you have to deny some of the things when your kids look at you and look exactly like them, you know.
Sure.
And so I do wish her well, and I hope that she, you know, finds her way, but it's up to her to find her way because it was up to me to find my way, and that's what I've been working on the last 40 some years or whatever. But it wasn't a process of one day I got up and went aha. You know, it was a huge transition, and I found out my brother was gay, and funny, he was 9 months younger than I. He's passed away since, and he was a real good friend. And I found out he was gay. Living with him all those years, I didn't know that. And, you know, it was just something we never, you know, got together and said, oh, I'm gay and you're gay. And I was this great, you know, because it just wasn't that way. It was undefined. So
sure.
An answer to your question. Sorry about that.
But no, not at all. But so you decided to leave your wife. And at that point, then... and now you weren't with your partner yet at that point, with Dan
no.
or were, no, okay.
No.
But you knew you wanted to, keep custody of your children.
Well, I always loved my children and the best thing I thought when I went for my divorce was, okay, the kids will stay with their mother. I'll pay support and everything will be hunky dory. And I can fly in on the weekends and be the wonderful guy that, you know, does all the fun stuff.
Sure,
you know?
Okay.
And I was really thinking that would happen that way. And then she remarried, and the kids then had a stepfather who was way younger than she. And he just wasn't right. Mm-hmm. He wasn't the type of person that I even wanted around my kids. Mm-hmm. So I got to checking, and I got to looking, and my kids were losing weight. They were missing school. They were... lots of visual things happening, and they were not happy. Of course, they didn't want to come and live with me either. You know, kids don't want, at that age, where they were like 3, 6, 3, 5, 6, and 9.
Okay.
And it was presented to me that maybe I could get custody. Mm-hmm. And so I found an attorney, John Fox was the fellow's name, who's since passed away himself. And blatantly, you know, told him, you know, what I was looking at. He basically told me that, you know, she could prove me unfit, I could prove her unfit, and then the kids would go into foster home. So I left that alone for a while, but then it got so bad that it was like I was going to do it.
Yeah,
so,
but that had to be so frightening.
Well, it was frightening.
Yeah.
And but later on, years later, I found out that my children were being sexually abused by this fella. And I guess you know the things that you're supposed to know in the time that you know them.
Yeah.
Because I probably would have been a little bit more, you know, a contract or something on the guy, you know, or whatever. I mean, you know, I'd have probably done something way more radical. So, it went on and on for 4 years. We filed custody. By this time, I'd met Daniel, and he said, if you feel like you need to do that, do it. And I think basically what he was saying was, I'll support you.
Yeah.
But if you think you need to do it, go for it. So I filed custody in 1972, and it took April 26, 1976 is when the custody was switched to me.
Mm-hmm.
And Daniel, of course, was told to move out at that time because I lied in court and said, no, I'm not gay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a real good friend of mine.
And you really didn't have much choice at that point.
Well, that, you know, that was a big fat lie, and I'm glad that I did it. You know, it was, it just wasn't something I think you could stand up in 1974 or whatever mm-hmm. and say, oh, yeah, I'm gay and I want my kids to come and live with me and this is my lover and
yeah.
we're going to live happily ever after in the suburbs of, you know, Indianapolis. And so that's sort of mapped out in the book or whatever. But even after the custody was switched to me and Dan was told to move out, and he did for a moment. And things sort of calmed down, and I was still thinking maybe I should marry and have an arrangement with a woman. Mm. Maybe I should, you know, so that we all look so normal and, you know, whatever. And I even told Dan that I was going to sort of check that out, and he wasn't terribly happy with that.
Yeah.
I did, and it didn't. That wasn't the way to go. I must mention that I have, you know, an amazing friend, and her name is Toni Bess, and she stood by me and, you know, was there every time I needed her, every time that I went to court. Dan sort of fell into the background, faded into the background a little bit. And when we were actually doing the court scene, we looked like a really super couple because my friend Toni Bess was with me. She was on my arm. She was supporting me. She knew what I was going for. She was and she was going to support me 100%, and did, and testified for me, and basically was my girlfriend, you know, as a visual situation. Well, she was a girl, and she was my friend. That's for sure, you know. So, but
what about your kids during this time? Did you know, what were you hearing from them, and did they know or on some level know about your relationship with Dan?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they knew. They actually, when they would come on the weekends, Dan would be there. And, you know, they knew, you know, basically that I never did admit that to them when we were going through all this because I was in that sort of denial mode to society also.
True.
And, and they were small. They were like 9 and, you know, under. And it was like, I'm not going to talk to you about that right now. And because I didn't know what the heck I was doing either. You know, I mean, I was just sort of putting out fires and covering up and, you know, seeing what I could get, you know, get done. Now, when custody was changed, though, and they did come to live with us, they lived with us for about 4 to 6 weeks. And then we sat down and had a talk. And, of course, then they were angry because they said you weren't, and now you're saying you are. Now what are you? Are you not? Or, you know, whatever. And and they didn't want to come. They didn't want to be in Noblesville. they wanted to stay with their mother where they were most comfortable. And that's what came out in the interviews when they were interviewed. Do you want to live with your mom or you want to live with your dad? It's like, well, we want to live with my mom. You know, we don't want to live with dad. So it took a while.
Yeah, that had to be tough.
Yeah, it was.
But now, I mean, you're a great-grandfather?
Great-grandfather 3 times, 3 little girls, yeah.
Congratulations
my son's
on that.
50, thank you. Mm-hmm. My son's 50, and my daughter's 47, 45, and 43, and I won't tell you which ones because I'm not sure which ones. Don't want their age, you know, brought up. But, yes, I have 8 grandchildren, and I have three great-granddaughters. And
like you said in the introduction, you're just like any other family.
You know, what I realized after the book was finished was it was just we were a couple raising kids. Mm-hmm. And we did all the same things that everybody does. We went to skating rinks and we did pom-pom girls and we did music lessons and we did ball games and we did all those things. And I think it even amazed me when the book was finished and I read it that, well, we were just two people raising kids and doing what needed to be done. And we got to be known in Noblesville as Van and Dan by our mechanic, by the teachers, by everybody. They knew what was going on, and it was there wasn't a huge problem with it, really. There's a few escapades or whatever in the book that that came to pass that makes it very interesting. But the kids basically still have their friends that they had when they were in high school. In fact, my daughter went to her high school, her 20th high school reunion, one of my daughters, and one of their friends said, well, how's Van and Dan doing? And she said, they're doing okay. I said, maybe next time I should just take you guys with me. and she said, what was funny was the girl said, Van and Dan's the only ones that are still together. Everybody else were divorced. All the other parents were divorced. So anyway, It's my kids are super duper, and they've had their challenges, but here we are, 2013.
Van, tell me about the title, On the Table by the Window.
On the Table by the Window. It started out to be my family on the table by the window. The journey of a gay dad in Indiana. That's for search on, mm-hmm. when you go search to make sure you don't end up buying a table or whatever, so you have to do that in publishing, I found out. But my agent suggested that it be On the Table by the Window and take my family off of it. But mm-hmm. the title basically is a title that stuck in my head during the holidays. We always ate dinner and supper. It was breakfast, mm-hmm. dinner, and supper. And dinner was the big meal of the day. My grandmother always prepared that, and it went on the table about 12:30. But during the holidays, when everybody was coming, the dinner was then put off to somewhere around 2 so that everybody could be there. And I remember my uncle. He would say, come on, Mom. Let's eat. It's time. Let's eat. And she said, no, I'm going to wait for the family to get here. And he goes, well, hell, they're over there on the table by the window. They're already here.
So the photographs of them, right?
Yeah, and it was just photographs of this big, huge table. Mm-hmm. And the front of my book shows that it's the table with all the pictures on it or whatever. And I guess, basically, I had the name before I had the book. So I do things a little bit, dyslexically. But anyway, it has proven to be a good title, and it's cohesive and it's put together pretty well. So,
well, and it's a great story just about your efforts and a family's efforts, and that's what it is.
Well, it is. It's sort of the journey, and mm-hmm. Chapter number 4 actually was chapter number 1 when we started, mm-hmm. and that was the April 26, 1976, when the kids actually came to live with us. But as we progressed into this, David came back and said, and this is his mastermind, he said, people are going to want to know more about you.
Sure.
And so we moved chapter number 1, moved to chapter 4, and then from 1 to 3, it's more about me and how mm-hmm. I grew up. And, I was sexually abused as a child, and it was one of those things that when I told my parents, they said, you don't tell anybody that. You keep that to yourself. You don't talk about that. So years later, my inner voice, which is my parents,
sure.
your inner voice is of your parents, or it becomes your inner voice as you get older. Every time I would meet somebody, I would always think of that, like, ooh, I don't want them to know. Mm-hmm. I don't want them to know about that. And so I was always keeping this secret or harboring this secret. And then, of course, when I found that there were people like me, more people like me, I could be a little bit more open. But yet, when I put the book together, I really let it fly, mm-hmm. And everybody's name is their name. Mm-hmm. I didn't change it. I didn't go fiction on anybody. I didn't change their, John's name to Jim and, whatever. So it's all out there. So I guess you could say in October when the book came out, I came out too. So now they know. They know the story.
Well, Van, thank you so much for coming into Art of the Matter today and sharing your story with us.
Well, thank you, sir, for having me.
Travis DiNicola with Van Kirby. His memoir, On the Table by the Window, The Journey of a Gay Dad in Indiana, that he co-wrote with David Hoppe, can be found at local bookstores. You can also get more information at HoosierGayDad.com. Again, HoosierGayDad.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
The Integrated Exhibit Alliance is a new initiative with a goal of bringing multiple organizations together to explore a single topic in concurrent events at multiple locations. This month, the pilot project explores the 1960s as a transformative era. The Michael Feinstein Great American Songbook Initiative Gallery is opening an exhibit on 1960s Broadway musicals, for example. Each museum and library will pull from its own collections to create an exhibit focusing on social events, arts, and culture. All the exhibits will be free to the public, and you can get a passport that guides you to all the exhibitions. Sharon Gamble invited Lisa Lobdell, archivist for the Michael Feinstein Great American Songbook Initiative, and Brenda Burke, philanthropic studies archivist at IUPUI's University Library, to our studios to learn more about this unique initiative.
All right, so this is a brilliant idea, this Integrated Exhibit Alliance. Where did it start?
Well,
Brenda's pointing at Lisa.
I had last year just recently installed an exhibit on 20s jazz, mm-hmm. and Prohibition.
Where?
At the Michael Feinstein Great American Songbook Initiative in mm-hmm. our gallery, which yep. is located in the Palladium in Carmel. And I happened to notice on Brenda's website at the IUPUI archives that their new exhibit, wait a minute, maybe it was G.I. Jive, maybe it was the 40s, the one before that. Mm-hmm. But anyway, her exhibit kind of paralleled the one that I had just taken down. And so we were talking, and I said, you know, it's really a shame we couldn't have scheduled those more closely together and kind of played off each other's exhibits. And she said, great, let's do it. And it was then that I realized I'd opened my big mouth.
And then I was looking for more partners, actually,
yes.
to really expand upon it. And so it's really been a grassroots effort to
yes.
get more local institutions involved in doing this.
Yeah, so we put our kind of put our heads together, and we both sent out emails to the other people that we knew in town, and got a small group together to meet. And some of them, because their schedules, their exhibit schedules go so far out, they're planned to 2015, 2016, they couldn't work with us this time, but maybe they will in the future. So.
But the ones that are smaller and have a more flexible schedule, we were able to really get them involved at this stage of the game. So besides our two institutions, there's the Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library, the Indiana Historical Society, and the Carmel Clay Historical Society. So it's a good group to start off with.
Sure. Now, I'm sure that because there are with every professional position, I'm sure there are archivists, professional service organizations. But is there some place, some person, some entity in the state that kind of has the overview of what resides in all of the archives, in all of the institutions?
No.
Because it's too big a task? Or...
I would say we've got the Society of Indiana Archivists, which is a professional organization, but you also have the Indiana Historical Society and the work that they do with local historical societies. So a lot of it comes down to resources, I would say, mm-hmm. is correct. And so it's finding the resources or the mechanisms to be able to bring all of this together.
Mm-hmm. So are there... at some of these organizations, you know, the scope of these, the Indiana Historical Society, Carmel Clay Historical Society, IUPUI, Michael Feinstein, Great American Songbook, Vonnegut Library, those are staffs and budgets of dramatically different sizes. And in some cases, staff, there's a lot more staff than in others. So lead us through how this works so far, or maybe how you envision it working in the future.
Well, it is very grassroots, like Brenda said. A person from each organization was designated as the spokesperson, and we worked together mostly by phone and just kind of came up with the theme that we wanted to focus on, which was the 1960s, with the 50th anniversary of JFK's assassination and the riots and so many other things going on during that period. And I have to admit, at first I wasn't real enthusiastic about covering that period because the songbook kind of falls apart in the 60s with the advent of rock and roll.
But, sure.
But we chose that period, and we have mostly worked by phone and email. Just with funding, you know, everybody's exhibit is a little different. My exhibit takes up my whole exhibit space. The Indiana Historical Society is using their reading room and their exhibit cases there. And Brenda's is a little different as well.
We're just using our exhibit cases that are in the Ruth Lilly Special Collections and Archives. And, you know, it's nothing fancy, but it's a way to highlight the collections that we do have within our holdings and to fit it into this broader theme, actually.
Mm-hmm. I love the idea that you're creating or have created a passport where people can kind of find their way, because mm-hmm. my sense is that any given person who comes to see one of your exhibits won't have been to all of the other venues. They might not know, for example, that they could go mm-hmm. into the Lilly Library.
And that's what's really nice about the passport is it's really broadening the audiences for each of our institutions to be able to see, oh, I can, you know, see the connection with the Michael Feinstein, see the connection with Carmel Clay, and that, and to really be able to explore the different venues. So that's what we're really hoping. It's mm-hmm. to really broaden our audiences. And that's one of the reasons we jumped on right away in doing this project was it could bring a whole new audience and to our collections and our
sure.
holdings, because we have the Philanthropic Studies Archives at our place. So a lot of the local nonprofit institutions and that, the records that we have, we can see what they were doing in the 60s and highlight that within our collection.
Cool. So philosophically, is the idea to maybe have with each project more complementarity than similarity, in other words, or will that just naturally happen because your holdings are so different from one another?
I think it's going to naturally happen. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things is we don't have, like we said, this is grassroots. We don't have a lot of rules and regulations
sure.
about, you know, you have to spend. The one thing we did say is that the exhibits have to be up for a certain amount of time. And here is the time frame. Can you do it during that time frame? But beyond that, then, you know, it's what your institution can do and mm-hmm. how it can fit in.
Yes. So let's talk about what's in the Great American Songbook Collection in the 60s, because I'm in the back of my mind, I'm trying to think about what music I know about in the 60s. So,
well, we've decided to focus on Broadway musicals of the 1960s.
Ah.
And how those changed during that decade based on the social changes that were going on around it and some of the topics that were covered during that period in musicals that hadn't been covered in the past.
For example?
Well, when you get to the mid-1960s, you have Fiddler on the Roof, Man of La Mancha, and Cabaret.
Mm.
And they cover oppression, discrimination, abortion, just a whole gamut of things, along with the generation gap that we see in Fiddler on the Roof. Those were things that were not covered in the 40s and 50s, or if they were, it was kind of glossed over, or not really part of the, you know, it was just kind of an after the fact. So we covered that, but then we have items on display from our collections. We have Meredith Willson's papers. Meredith Willson wrote Unsinkable Molly Brown, and that went to stage in the 60s. So we have items from his collection, as well as playbills and sheet music and some of those pieces.
What a treat. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of fun. And your archives?
I'm at the IUPUI University Library in our Special Collections and Archives. So what we looked at is challenging the norms is kind of our sub-theme or subtitle to our exhibit. And so we have the university archives there. So we're looking at the creation of IUPUI, so the growth of higher education.
When was that?
In 69 is when that happened. So it's at
feels
the
like
end
it's
of
always
the decade.
Been here.
And no, it has been with all the different predecessor schools, actually.
Sure.
So that's how we looked at it is, you know, we looked at how IUPUI came about, but we looked at higher education because it was in our city and with Indiana University, with the School of Medicine, Dentistry, Law, and that type of thing and how it came about. Also, we have the philanthropy collection. So with that, there's a lot of the different social service organizations locally, Boys and Girls Club, Altrusa, National Council for Jewish Women. So we could really look at a broad different of social issues that were happening. And on the globalization effort, too, we were looking at different things with our Kiwanis International Collection, the different types of programming that they were doing in third world countries and challenging the norms on different treatments and vaccinations and that type of thing. Also, civil rights was very important during that time frame. So with National FFA Organization, we can talk about the merger that happened with the New Farmers of America, which was the African-American component of basically FFA at that time. So we really got a broad range. So it was challenging the norms and trying to make people think about what was happening during that time frame.
Wow. Are you aware of other cities where librarians and in particular archivists are doing something like this?
The only one was Michigan had something that was very similar. But no, not really.
It sounds so brilliantly simple that you're like, well, why didn't someone think of this before?
That's what we were talking
Lisa's
about
going,
when we started.
Because it's more work. Bless you for being willing to do that. Can you give us a sneak peek of what some upcoming shared topics might be?
We're looking at the bicentennial.
Oh, yes, sure.
Is a big thing, I think, coming up in 1916. Or 2016. Sorry.
It sounded so natural when you said it.
He spent a lot of time in the past. Yeah. So.
That makes great sense. Anything you'd secretly like to get on the agenda? Something that's really strong in your collection that you are just...
I think one that we're really looking at is agriculture, and that's really tying it into the bicentennial, is really looking at what effect agriculture had on the state. And we're actually looking at different projects with Purdue University because they are a strong agricultural college. So it ties into their collections and some of our collections that we have here. And I think, you know, we can start seeing how it maybe ties in with some of the other organizations, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Lisa, secret desires for your collection?
Well, if we focus on home in 2016 and this bicentennial celebration, I'm getting a nudge to try to get Dorothy's red shoes.
Ooh, fun.
So we'll see if I can pull that off.
Because there truly is no place like home.
There truly is.
There's 16 pairs out there.
What? Wait, why are there 16 pairs?
There's more than one. Mm-hmm. Well,
I think for the filming, there's supposedly 16 pairs. So
the sequins kept popping off when she clicked her heels together. Who knew? You know, before we turned the microphones on, you said, you know, archivists do know how to hide things. So you have some interesting information in your collections and elsewhere.
See, and that's our problem is we need to really make it much more public. And so opportunities like this really help us be able to make people aware of our collections and hopefully be able to use our resources more.
And is that, I think you just answered this, but what would you like people to do after they've come to see one or more of these exhibits?
We're hoping that people will go see all five of the exhibits and then maybe start to look deeper themselves into this period and do some research on their own. So, and we didn't mention, but all of the exhibits are free.
Free is good.
That's true.
Sharon Gamble with Lisa Lubdel, archivist for the Michael Feinstein Great American Songbook Initiative, and Brenda Burke, philanthropic studies archivist at IUPUI's University Library. The Integrated Exhibit Alliance comprises the Michael Feinstein Great American Songbook Initiative, Kurt Vonnegut Memorial Library, Indiana Historical Society, the Carmel Clay Historical Society, and IUPUI's Ruth Lilly Special Collections and Archives. You can also search on Facebook for more information about the Integrated Exhibit Alliance.
Hey, this coming weekend might be a long weekend for you as you're celebrating the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We have some events to help you do that on our calendar we call
What Do We Do?
What do you got?
Well, the Rhythm Discovery Center, which is located downtown, sort of just below the Arts Garden and Weber Grill, they are partnering with the Indianapolis Jazz Foundation, and they are presenting a special discussion and performance on Monday, the 20th, at 11 a.m. And with this program, they are also offering free admission to the center all day from 10 to 5 to honor the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. and jazz in Indianapolis. And so part of this program, they're going to be working with the Indianapolis Public Library Learning Curve, and they're going to be doing some stuff as well with Speak Out and Be Heard with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra percussionist Paul Burns, and all types of other cool stuff going on throughout the day. If you've never been down there, it's a great place to take your kids because there's a lot of interactive drumming exhibits where they can really pound on things.
And grown-ups can do it too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Which is a good thing too. So it's a great day to go check out Rhythm Discovery Center on Monday.
And if you're out and about, you can go a stone's throw further west to the Eiteljord, which is offering on Dr. MLK Jr. Day free admission with a canned food donation, which they will give to Gleaners Food Bank. And there's all sorts of great stuff to see at the Eiteljord. Just a lovely, lovely day to visit the Eiteljord. That's this coming Monday, January 20th, 10 to 5.
There's also some cool things going on this weekend as well, prior to Martin Luther King, including Tribes at the Phoenix Theater, which is running through February 9th and is getting some great reviews. Really sort of interesting family drama. Winner of the 2012 Drama Desk Award for Outstanding Play. It's the Indiana premiere.
Has a lot of humor in it, too. I saw it on Sunday, so yay. Film historian Eric Grayson is going to screen the 1929 Marx Brothers film The Coconuts on Saturday the 25th at 7 o'clock at the Garfield Park Arts Center. I'm not even going to tell you the plot. It's too twisty and crazy. It's the Marx Brothers.
Yeah,
if you don't know the
coconuts.
Marx Brothers, this is a great introduction to them. Admission is $5. Concessions are $1. Again, that's at the Garfield Park Arts Center. More information at gpacarts.org. And by the way, it's a family-friendly film, but you're going to have to explain a lot of stuff about the Marx Brothers to little kids that you take with you.
Oh, just be prepared. Hey, a pretty big concert coming up next week, Thursday the 23rd at Hilbert Circle Theater as part of their Happy Hour at the Symphony. The Indianapolis sister duo Lily and Madeline are going to be playing there, and tickets are going fast for that. These ladies are quite popular right now and definitely worth checking out. That's going to be a great concert next Thursday at the Symphony.
Hey, on Friday the 17th, Indie Baroque Music is presenting Ensemble Voltaire in This Is the End. No, it's not an apocalyptic concert. It's a celebration of the music of the transition period between the Baroque and the Classical eras. It'll be at Trinity Episcopal Church in Indianapolis on Friday the 17th at 7:30. They're also going to repeat it at the Athenaeum on Sunday the 19th at 7:30. Expect music by two generations of the Bach family, as well as Telemann and Mozart. More information at indiebaroque.org.
Very good. Well, Sharon, that's all the time that we have on this calendar, but we will be back next week for the thing we call
What'll We Do?
We wanted to take a moment to acknowledge the passing last week of the sculptor and teacher Gary Freeman, who taught at Heron. His work you may have seen. One of his most famous pieces is titled For Endless Trees, and it's right in front of WFYI Studios.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Indianapolis Star arts reporter Michael Anthony Adams originally set out to read a book a week last year. That didn't quite work, so this year he's readjusting his own goals and asking the community to join in for #Read26Indy. Travis DiNicola spoke with Adams about the project.
Michael, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here.
Travis, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So let me get this right. This basically started as an idea you had that was a tweet.
It's an even stranger story. I was in the newsroom. I'm a reporter for the Indianapolis Star, and I was.
And you've been here what? About three months. 3 months. Okay.
3 months. Yeah, I started in October, at the tail end of October.
Okay.
And so I was in the newsroom. And I had to use the restroom. So I pop into the restroom. Good time to check Twitter. Right. So I'm on Twitter, and you know, I start thinking about Goodreads has a challenge that you can set up for yourself every year, and Goodreads is a website that's similar to, you know, Facebook, where you can go on and share your thoughts on whatever you're reading. So anyways, they have a you know, they have this this challenge, and you can set, you know, a certain amount of books that you want to read every year. So last year, I set it up, and I was going to read 40 books. Well, I was out of work last year, so I spent most of my time looking for work and not reading. So, you know, I sat down, and, well, I was in the restroom, and so I sent out a tweet saying, look, Indianapolis, you know, hold me accountable for what I'm going to be reading this year. You know, I'm going to read at least two books a month. So, you know, a book every 2 weeks. And that's where I got the number 26. I just took 52 and, you know, divided it by two.
Now, at one point, were you actually thinking about trying to read a book a week? Is that right?
It was going to be a book a week. But then, you know, trying to balance work, you know, I am a writer. So, I'm reading a lot and writing a lot for work. So I didn't want to strain myself too much.
Yeah, okay.
So one book every 2 weeks to me seems like a pretty attainable goal for many people. I think, you know, we're pounded by all these distractions, and you know, the one book every 2 weeks really seems to me, you know, the perfect number.
Now, you said you started this with Good Books, which is a website that you know, a lot of people who love reading, you know, flock to and stuff. But it's kind of gotten a whole new life of its own, right? I mean, because this did not start as an official, like, indie star thing.
No. Yeah. In fact, it was just, like I said, it was just a simple tweet. I really didn't think that it was going to take on the life that it has. But I, you know, what I think is so special about it is that it's become something different to everybody, you know, to anybody that's participating.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily those who weren't on Twitter before. Now, I've had a few instances where people are actually joining Twitter just to participate in Read 26 Indie.
And it's hashtag Read 26 Indie.
Correct.
Right?
It's hashtag Read 26 Indie.
So the idea is, if you're on Twitter, you're going to get on Twitter, then what, you tweet each week or every other week about what you're reading?
Not even every other week. It can be every day. You know, what's your experience reading? I mean, what characters are you liking or disliking? What page are you on? Are you having a cocktail while you're reading your book? You know, what coffee shop are you at? Where are you reading? It's just the culture of reading that I think I'm really trying to hone in on, and it's that idea that, you know, almost like a book club, city book club, where, you know, we're not giving you a book to read. You're telling us what you're reading, and, you know, you're sharing what you're reading. You know, you're giving recommendations, and that's really what it's all about.
And not, you know, everyone reading the same thing necessarily,
right?
Not meeting at a certain time,
right?
But talking about what you're reading. In fact, as we're recording this, I just retweeted the tweet that you tweeted about recording this interview to talk about hashtag Read26Indie.
And that's what it's really, just you know, getting out there and communicating with people. And Twitter just seemed the most, I mean, I didn't have a plan for this, but it just seems like the most natural platform to use for something like this project.
So what's the response been so far from other people that have been joining in with you on this?
It's been great. In fact, you know, there's Indiana authors who are reaching out to me and just, you know, loving the idea, and I'm so glad they're on board. Ben Winter comes to mind. Ben,
great author, yep.
Yeah, excellent author, and he is, you know, he's just been on board. He's been so active in the Read 26 project, and people are catching on.
Ben's got a great series. The second of the three books in the series is out already. It's the Last Policeman series.
Mm-hmm, correct.
Really sort of, you know, end of the world type of detective story. It's
right.
Just incredibly well written.
Right.
Yeah.
So he, you know, he's been, you know, he's been instrumental in this whole thing. And another great story I have is a girl, an actress here in Indianapolis. She has a younger sister who I'm not sure of the age. I know she's quite a bit younger than, you know, probably in her, you know, early teens. But she wasn't on Twitter, but she joined Twitter just to be a part of Read 26 Indie. And, you know, she's on there and tweeting about what she's reading. it's great just to see the spectrum of what people are reading as well.
So what are you reading for your...
Currently, right, well, I just finished...
You started with Slaughterhouse-Five, right?
I started with Slaughterhouse-Five. I'm really embarrassed to say that I hadn't read any Vonnegut, but I just finished it.
That seemed like a great one to kick off this
year. Yeah, absolutely. I felt I'd pay a homage to mm-hmm. Mr. Mm-hmm. Vonnegut. Mm-hmm. But my next book I'm reading now is by James Agee. It's called Let Us Now Praise Famous Men.
Sure.
And in the summer of 1936, he went down to Alabama and lived among the tenants and the farmers down there.
Mm-hmm.
So Evan Walker, the photographer, went along with him, and they have these portraits of these people that were living in, you know, the Dust Bowl era America.
Yeah, that's an incredibly, you know, famous book in terms of the reporting and the portraits of the people. So you're not limiting this at all to fiction, nonfiction, books, old books, classics.
Exactly, all over the place. In fact, I've made a rule for myself, and that's another thing about Read 26. There's no rules. You know, mm-hmm. it's whatever you want to make it. So what I'm going to be doing is reading a fiction, nonfiction, and then just alternate all the way through the year.
Cool. Do you have a list yet, or are you just going to sort of see where it goes?
You know what? I have hundreds of books on my shelves, and you know, it's more fun just to go and look around on, you know, my collection, and or go to a bookstore like Indie Reads,
mm-hmm.
or you know, go to the library and just browse, and then whatever pops out. But I will say that I think my next fiction book after Let Us Now Praise Famous Men will be Dan Wakefield's Probably Starting Over. I think that's mm-hmm. the one that I really want to want to attempt. Yeah, because Dan's another author that
great local author. And
yeah,
great
and so I want to stick with authors that I really haven't read before.
So this is also a way for you to kind of get to know the city and the arts community. I mean, you said you've, you know, been here at the Stars since October.
Yes.
Where are you from originally, Michael?
I'm originally from Detroit.
Okay. So you know, Indiana is in Indianapolis somewhat new to you in some
ways.
Yeah,
well, absolutely. I mean, I lived in Detroit, and then I moved out to Los Angeles, and, you know, I've lived in Boston where I went to school, mm-hmm. and then I, you know, lived in Chicago. So each time I venture to a new city, I make it a point to go to I'm a big literature guy, but I haven't mm-hmm. been, you know, I've only been, you know, really into books since I was 18 years old. So I make it a point to go and see the city's, you know, literary hotspots, whether it's an author's grave or somewhere, you know, writers would hang out and chat. So that to me is the great part about Indianapolis, is that I get to discover a whole new writing culture.
And a great, great rich history here. I mean, going back, of course, to, you know, Booth Tarkington. And,
yeah.
And, you know, that's a Magnificent Ambersons is just a terrific book, as, you know, as many of his other works are. And that might
right.
be something, you know, put on your list at some point. I know that you're also going to be doing some events at different places. I mean, you've got one scheduled at Indie Reads Books at the
yes.
end of the month on the 29th, and then at some other places. Tell me about those. How does that
connect
to all
this? So my after this thing really took off, mm-hmm. what I really wanted to do is get people together, you know, face-to-face. You know, a chance to bring books that they're reading that they've already read that they love and swap. So I want to encourage people to, you know, bring books to swap with others. So the first Indie Reads event will be Wednesday, January 29th from 6:30 to 8:30.
Okay.
And what we're going to be doing really is just, you know, having a conversation. I'm hoping that a special guest will be appearing.
Mm-hmm.
That's still in the works. There's a lot of things that that we're going to try and see if they work out, but really it's just people getting together, talking about what they're reading. I encourage people who come to, you know, bring pieces of writing that they're working on. If you know, if you're a writer, a poet, you know, I would love for people to get up and talk about, you know, their own writing as well as, you know, what they're reading. I mean, it's an open book club. Everyone is invited and encouraged to come and share their thoughts on reading and the journeys that they've taken.
You know, one thing that I think is pretty cool about this is that even though this started out as just something that you were doing personally, because you have the benefit of working at the Star has actually picked this up and is helping to promote it now.
Oh yeah, the Indie Star has been great, and I really think that if I didn't have that presence on Twitter that I do through the Star, this wouldn't have been able to take off and grow as it has. It's the opportune time for me to do things like this when I do have a following.
How did that work? I'm curious. I mean, did you you know, get it started and then, you know, sort of pitch it to your editors? Or did they notice that you were doing this and said, hey, we want to cover this more?
Well, I put it out there and all of a sudden it got 20 retweets in the first, you know, 20 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And so we have, you know, social media gurus, and they notice things like this, you know, when things are trending. And all of a sudden I started trending in Indianapolis. And I was like, when I started the job, when I started the job, I had 87 Twitter followers, and all of a sudden I was getting, you know, 100, 200 followers in a day. So they saw this taking off, and
obviously there was a hunger for it.
Yeah. And that's the great thing is that, you know, just reading it, everybody loves to read, you know, no matter what platform it's on, you know, hardbacks, paperbacks, or e-readers. I mean, everyone is reading and they love to consume. So
and reading is such a solitary activity that you know, being able to talk about it and share, you know, is something that I know a lot of people really do crave.
Yeah, and I think this is the perfect opportunity to, you know, to get together and to talk about not only authors, but just, you know, the adventures you can take while reading a book. Mm-hmm. I know it's so fundamental. I mean, reading, there's a great quote by William Faulkner, and he encourages young writers to, you know, to read everything, trash, classics, you know, read everything, read. And, you know, there's another great quote by Stephen King that says, if you don't have the time to read, then you don't have the time or the tools to write. So I really have taken those quotes to heart. And I really just hope that people understand that this, you know, I just want Read 26 Indie to be to the public what, you know, whatever they want it to be.
Excellent. Michael, thank you so much for coming into Art of the Matter, and looking forward to helping you fulfill your New Year's resolution. Read those 26 books, and let's talk more about it. Thanks so much.
Travis, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Travis DiNicola with Indianapolis Star arts reporter Michael Anthony Adams. You can find out more at hashtag Read26Indie by Googling it or looking on Twitter or visiting the Indie Star website.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll find out about a new residence with an art gallery. It's called Artistry.
I'll talk with blind artist Barbara Magnus Hopkins.
And then I'll find out what it means to defend the caveman. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.